Good evening, church. It's good to see you all this evening. You can open your Bibles to Luke chapter 6. Luke chapter 6 is where we're going to begin in just a few minutes. Continuing with our lessons in Luke and looking at these different principles surrounding discipleship in this gospel. Last week we looked at Luke chapter 5, at least the first little bit of Luke chapter 5. And in that chapter, if we had to kind of headline that chapter, or at least headline the section that we looked at in the first 11 verses, I would headline it as the call of discipleship. And so we kind of looked at that story in the first 11 verses where Jesus goes and he calls those who would become one of his first disciples, some of his first disciples, and kind of takes them through that process. And we noted that that's really one of the most common commands and things that Jesus would say to people. He goes to people and he says, follow me. And he repeats that over and over and over. And we learn really what that means and what it doesn't mean, while also kind of comparing Luke chapter 5 with Luke chapter 14. And those great crowds that followed Jesus but weren't willing to be his disciples or able to be his disciples because they didn't leave everything and follow him, whereas in Luke chapter 5, we see that that happened. And we noted this kind of process that Jesus took those men through in Luke 5, where first he kind of encourages them to listen to him, and then he asks to kind of inconvenience them by saying, you know, can I get in your boat? And then he asks them to trust him and gives them kind of fishing advice, maybe something that they would assume he wouldn't know anything about, finally revealing really to them who he is, that he is the Lord, that he is the Christ and needs to be followed, and then tells them, I'm going to change you. That's what discipleship is. I will change your purpose, change your mission, and really change everything about you, and then they leave everything and go and follow after him. So there's the call of discipleship in Luke chapter 5. In chapter 6, what I think we have, and specifically starting in verse 12, is Jesus starting to define and further show what discipleship is. And so in verse 12, he'll really start calling people for specific roles and purposes, and we're familiar with this, where he calls these 12 guys to be his apostles. And then he'll have this pretty long discourse at the end of the chapter talking about discipleship. And so I want to start reading in Luke 6, verse 12, and kind of set the stage for this speech that Jesus will have starting in verse 20. So Luke chapter 6, verse 12 says, in these days he went out on a mountain to pray, and all night he continued in prayer to God. And when day came, he called his disciples and chose from them 12, who he named apostles, Simon, whom he named Peter, and Andrew his brother, and James and John, and Philip and Bartholomew, and Matthew and Thomas, and James the son of Alphaeus, and Simon, who was called the Zealot, and Judas the son of James, and Judas Iscariot, who became a traitor. And he came and down with them and stood on a level place. And when a great crowd of his disciples and a great multitude of people from all Judea and all Jerusalem and from the seacoast of Tyre and Sidon, they came to hear him and to be healed of their diseases. And those who were troubled with unclean spirits were cured. And all of the crowd sought to touch him, for power came out of him and healed them all. And he lifted up his eyes on his disciples, and he said, and we'll just stop right there, I know that's partway through the verse, but we see kind of opening this section, in the beginning in verse 12, Jesus is spending all night in prayer. And we see him various different times in the scripture, and we'll continue to see him in prayer and different times where he's praying fervently. But this is a moment that seems like a special occasion where he's especially devoted to prayer, staying up all night and asking God for this help and this great decision that he's about to make. And we can probably relate to that when there's a really big decision in our life that we're going to have to make, maybe in the following day, whether it's a career decision or whatever else. We'll spend an adequate amount of time in prayer asking God for wisdom and help in doing that. And Jesus is going to make this really massive decision of kind of exclusively selecting these 12 guys out of the crowd of disciples he's already had to be his guys. This is my A team. These are the people that I'm going to have that are going to get kind of exclusive rights to me, and I'm going to train and prepare and equip them for the work that will need to be done whenever Jesus goes back into heaven. And that's what we know these men go on to do in Acts chapter 2 and following. And so he does that, and after that selection of when he selects those 12 guys, he goes down into this level place in verse 17, and there's this big group of disciples that are around him, obviously I think including the 12 guys from previously, but there's also just great multitudes of people, a bunch of people from Judea, people from Tyre and Sidon, people from the seacoast, just all kinds of people are coming to him from all over to listen to him and be healed by him and have their spirits, the evil spirits cast out of them. Another similar or another familiar kind of picture and place that we see Jesus in. But in the midst of that massive crowd of people, he turns in verse 20 and he starts to teach. And I want to notice who the text says that he's teaching and who he's specifically talking to here. In verse 20, it says, he lifted up his eyes on his disciples and he said. So this is a specific kind of admonition to the disciples. There are a lot of people here, but not all of them are his disciples. But Jesus wants to take this time to talk specifically to his disciples. And I think that makes a lot of sense. I don't know if he's specifically kind of directing this at the apostles, because in the section prior to this, the apostles were just appointed, or if it's to the massive group of disciples. Either way would be really kind of the same thing. But you would expect that. If you've just kind of been appointed to a position, and we just saw in Luke chapter 5 the call of discipleship, what's the natural thing that you would want to know next? After you get a position, you want to know what's required of me. And so you get hired to a job, and what's day one usually like? Orientation. You learn what's expected of you, what kind of person you need to be, what kind of things you're going to have to do in your job and in your work. And so what really happens in the rest of Luke chapter 6 is Jesus goes through this whole process of describing the job of a Christian. It's the job description of what a Christian needs to be and how they need to live their life. And so I want us to read through this next section. We're not going to read through all of the rest of the chapter. We'll probably only get through verse 38. But I want to look and see what Jesus is saying, the role and the purpose, and really ultimately what the character of a disciple is, according to his words specifically directed at his disciples in this moment. So we'll start off just reading chapter 6, starting in verse 20, and we'll read through verse 26, and we're going to see kind of an overarching principle here. So Luke chapter 6, verse 20, he lifted up his eyes on his disciples and he said, "Blessed are you who are poor, for yours is the kingdom of God. Blessed are you who are hungry now, for you shall be satisfied. Blessed are you who weep now, for you shall laugh. Blessed are you when people hate you and when they exclude you and revile you and spurn your name as evil on account of the Son of Man. Rejoice in that day and leap for joy, for behold, your reward is great in heaven. For so the fathers did to the prophets. But woe to you who are rich, for you have received your consolation. Woe to you who are full now, for you shall be hungry. Woe to you who laugh now, for you shall mourn and weep. Woe to you when all people speak well of you, for so their fathers did to the false prophets." And so reading through that, kind of starting out this, that probably seems a little bit familiar to most of us. If you're familiar with the Gospel of Matthew, Matthew chapter 5, there's a really similar kind of beginning to a sermon here. But if you start comparing Matthew 5 and Luke 6, you'll notice some pretty big differences in the Beatitudes that are in Matthew 5 and the Beatitudes that are here in Luke 6. And that's not surprising, because this is a different occasion. And we see that from verse 17. In verse 17 of Luke 6, he's standing on a level place whenever he starts this discourse. And what do we call Matthew 5 through 8? The Sermon on the Mount. And so he's on a mountain in Matthew 5, but he's in a level place in Luke 6. So these are different occasions, but similar kind of content in the things that he's saying here. And so Jesus starts teaching in this different place. And instead of looking at each one of these kind of individually of what Jesus says, I want to kind of get a broad picture of this idea. What's the point? What's kind of the overarching message of these Beatitudes that are here in Luke chapter 6? And so in order to do that, anytime I want to take a specific text and find out what's the purpose of that text, a helpful practice, I think, is to kind of look for repeated words and phrases in that text, and that'll kind of shed some light on what the purpose or the meaning behind those words are. And you probably noticed a lot of repeated ideas and phrases in these verses. So it starts off in verse 20 and 20 through 23, talking about the blessed person and who the blessed person is. And it says, the blessed person are the people that are poor, they're the people that are hungry, they're the people that are weeping now, they're the people that are hated, that are scorned now. And the implication of all of those is because in the future, you're going to be satisfied, you're going to start laughing, you're going to be rewarded later on. So there's this kind of person that's blessed, that's suffering now, but will be rewarded later on, versus the person that's not blessed, or the one that gets the woes pronounced to them in 24 through 26. And those woes are to the people that are rich now, the people that are full now, the people who are laughing and happy now, and the people that are well spoken of now, because in the future, that's not going to be the case. So there's kind of inverses of what's going on with these two different groups of people. And so what Jesus is doing here, I believe, is making a distinction and a contrast between two sets or types of people and their character. And I don't think the distinction is simply just the content of like what's in their bellies and what's in their bank accounts, but it's something kind of deeper than that that sets these two groups apart. And so really what's happening in the deeper point and this character quality that's described, what Jesus is saying is the person who is blessed is the one who is living their life with a focus on the future reality versus the person and contrasted with the person that is living their life with a focus on the present reality and not concerned about the future and what's going to happen there. In other words, Jesus is saying the blessed man is the person who is focused on the future blessings and the rewards promised by God to him, and he is so focused on that that all of his decisions and his actions and his way of life are influencing his choices to enhance those blessings and make sure that he doesn't do anything that gets in the way of those blessings or would cost him those blessings that are going to come to him in the future. And so he abstains from any kind of actions that would compromise his reward from the Lord in the future. And he doesn't want to endanger those blessings at all. And so he's even willing to go through all these different things and hard things right now for the sake of receiving the promise later. So he'll go hungry. He'll be poor. He'll be hated so that he gets those blessings later on. Then you've got this different kind of person that's contrasted with that blessed person that, according to Jesus, is the person that lives his life and makes his decisions based on the immediate rewards, the things that he can get right now. And he values those immediate rewards more than the things that are in the future and the rewards to come. And therefore, he exchanges the far more valuable future things for the immediate gratification and getting pleasure right now in this life. It reminded me, and kind of noticing that difference, reminded me of a quote from C.S. Lewis. This is from his book, The Weight of Glory. And I think this is a really powerful observation that he made. He said, "It would seem that our Lord finds our desires not too strong, but too weak. We are half-hearted creatures, fooling about with drink and sex and ambition when infinite joy is offered us, like an ignorant child who wants to go on making mud pies in the slum because he cannot imagine what is meant by the offer of a holiday at the sea. We are far too easily pleased." And isn't that our society, right? People that, if you give them the option of choosing what is good now or what's great later, will often choose the good now. And oftentimes in life, that's not how those kinds of decisions are presented. Usually it's kind of camouflaged and they don't really offer the great later kind of thing. But there are all kinds of experiments and things that people have done that show a vast majority of people will take the immediate gratification rather than holding out and suffering a little bit to get the better thing later on. But Jesus says that's a massive difference. A disciple of Jesus is the kind of person that will wait, that will deny their immediate gratification and their immediate pleasure for the sake of getting the reward later on down the road. Someone once said also that he is no fool who gives up what he cannot keep to gain what he cannot lose. And that's really what Jesus' words are here. Giving up what you can't keep to gain this future reward that will not be taken away from you. That's the real blessing. That's the kind of person that Jesus is calling to be a disciple. And the basic kind of thing that will keep echoing through this message that Jesus is describing his disciples here in Luke 6. And so these Beatitudes in Luke chapter 6 imply that a life that is focused on receiving blessings will often result in us maybe being poor or hungry or sorrowful or scorned in our life. And likewise, a life or an indication that our life is not the life of a disciple could be a life that's full of pleasantness and comfort and relative ease. Those could be powerful indicators when we look at our life and decide, am I really the kind of disciple that Jesus wants us to be? And so verse 24 really gives a warning to the kind of life that is opposite of the life of a disciple. In verse 24... Jesus says, "Woe to you who are rich, for you have received your consolation." That phrase of what Jesus is saying there, "you have received your consolation," I think what he means by that is if you're content with just living life for now, living life for right now, getting the immediate gratification, the microwave generation kind of mentality, fine. I hope you're okay with what you get, because that's all you're going to get. You're only going to get the instant gratification, and then the rest of it is down the drain. You're not going to get anything else in the future. You're not storing up for yourself blessings to be reaped after this life. And we all realize that and we all know that. But what does that principle look like in our life? Well, we know that we need to be living for the future, living for God, storing up treasure in heaven. But what does that actually mean for our life? How is that idea helpful for us? How will that kind of change us and influence our decisions and our perspective in our life? And so I believe what Jesus does with this principle in verses 20 through 26 is he expounds on it through the rest of his speech and really kind of shows us three different areas that will be directly influenced if we start living our lives for the future rather than living our lives for the present right now. And maybe you would break these down in kind of different sections or categorize them differently, but in verse 27 through 38, I see three different things that will change and be affected when we start living our life by this principle. And so I'll give you those three things really quickly, and then we'll read through kind of one by one and notice the things that he says here in the text. The three areas of life that will be affected are: we will begin to love those that mistreat us. We will begin, number two is we will begin to give to those who can't repay us. And number three is we will forgive those who wrong us. So the person that is living for the future and not for now, those are the areas of life and decisions that will change for them when they adopt this principle. So let's work through each one of those one by one, starting in verse 27 and noticing those that are changed to love those that mistreat them. So verse 27 through verse 31 says, "But I say to you who hear, love your enemies, do good to those who hate you, and bless those who curse you. Pray for those who abuse you. To the one who strikes you on the cheek, offer him the other also. And from the one who takes away your cloak, do not withhold your tunic either. Give to everyone who begs from you. And from the one who takes away your goods, do not demand them back. And as you wish that others would do to you, so you do also to them." So this idea, loving those who mistreat you, I think that's primarily seen here in this section, among other things as well, but that's the big kind of idea in this paragraph. If we had to just kind of take a moment and grade ourselves, if you had to grade yourself on where you fall in the loving others department, what grade would you give yourself in that area? How loving am I to others? On like a A, B, C, D, E, F, or I guess there's not an E, but A, B, C, D, F grading scale. What grade would you get for loving others? If we give ourselves that kind of grade, I think after thinking about that for a while, we might start to want to kind of change the rules of that question and say, well, it really kind of depends on who you're talking about, because I love different people different ways. And some people are easier to love, right? In our lives, there are people that are almost kind of natural to love, that it would actually kind of take more effort to not love them than to love them. And so for some people, I'd get a really good grade, but then there's kind of everyone else. That if I was graded on my loving nature towards them, I probably wouldn't pass in that grade there. And so there are these people that that are kind of falling into this category that we really need to start thinking about, and really the people that Jesus identifies in this section of what kind of person Jesus calls us to love in this passage. In verse 27, he calls them our enemies. He goes on to call them those that hate you, those that curse you, those that abuse you, those that strike you, those people that steal from you. Those are the kinds of people that we're encouraged to love. That disciples are encouraged to love here. And we don't have the convenience of choosing not to love them. We're called to love those that are the hardest people to love in the world. That's what disciples are called to love, who they're called to love. So what does it really mean to love? Because at that moment, when you start to realize I need to love my enemies and people that really mistreat me and take advantage of me and all those kinds of things, that's a really convenient time to start defining love in the way that you want it to be defined. And maybe you define loving your enemies as, I love them, and so I have the restraint to not punch them in the face. And so that's how I love my enemies. I restrain myself, and that's my definition of loving my enemies, restraining myself from hurting them in some way. But how does Jesus define loving our enemies, or just loving people in general here in these sections? In verses 27, 28, and 29, showing love to these kinds of people is to do good to them, to be a blessing to them, to pray for them, to never retaliate when they do you wrong or when they strike you, and to give more to them when they've taken from you. That's the kind of love that Jesus is calling people to have. Not just a self-restraint of kind of gritting your teeth whenever you get close to them, but being a positive person kind of source of things in their life, a really good source of blessing for them. And so you ask yourself, and I ask myself this question, how many people do you love in this world? If you had to make a list, just write a list of all the people that you love in this world, how long would that list be? What kind of people would be on there? But if we made that question a little bit harder, if the standard of love in that question was the standard that Jesus has here in verses 27, 28, and 29, how long would that list be of people that you really love? If we had to make a list of people that we do good to, that we're a blessing to, that we pray for, that we never retaliate against when we're wronged, and that we give to even when they've taken from us. I mean, unfortunately for me, when I start thinking about that in my life, some of even my friends I don't treat that well, let alone my enemies. And so this is really kind of heavy criteria that Jesus has in loving people. And he says, love your enemies in this way. And you start thinking, what can motivate a disciple to be like that? What would motivate a disciple and motivate you and I to show this kind of love to people? And what I think, we'll keep coming back to this verse because it's a powerful verse. In verse 35, it gives us the answer. Verse 35 of Luke 6 says, but love your enemies and do good and lend, expecting nothing in return, and your reward will be great. And you will be sons of the Most High, for he is kind to the ungrateful and to the evil. It draws us back to the original point and the original overarching principle of a person, the people that will have the hardest time showing this kind of sacrificial love to their enemies are people that are living life for right now and not living life for the future. But if you live your life for the future and for the rewards and for the opportunity to be like God, it'll be much easier to show this kind of love to those that wrong us in different ways. And so the people that know that something is good, good is coming, they'll find it easier and find this inner determination, I think, to love even the hardest to love people in the world. So that's area number one of how our lives will be changed. Area number two starts in verse 32. And so the second area that we noticed is people that live their life looking for the future and not for the present gratification now will give to those that can't repay them. So Luke 6, verse 32. Says, if you love those who love you, what benefit is that to you? For even sinners love those who love them. And if you do good to those who do good to you, what benefit is that to you? For even sinners do the same. And if you lend to those from whom you expect to receive, what credit is that to you? Even sinners lend to sinners to get back the same amount. But love your enemies and do good and lend, expecting nothing in return, and your reward will be great, and you will be sons of the Most High, for he is kind to the ungrateful and to the evil. So maybe this idea is seen all throughout this text, but I think specifically verse 34 really talks about this idea of doing good to those that do good to you, and sinners even do that, and lending to those that lend from you, or that you expect to lend also back to you and receive from them. What Jesus is saying here in this section, I think, is think about the people that you give to. And this is a good question, I think, to think about. Who in the past, or who in your life, or who in the past year has experienced your generosity, like specifically you? If you thought about this last year, who are the people that have experienced your generosity in the last year? Maybe some of those people that have experienced your generosity are like your siblings, or your parents, or your coworkers, or your best friend, or your spouse, or whatever. I think what Jesus is saying here is that our list of people that we show generosity to ought to be filled with individuals who can in no way repay us for what we've given them. And it's not that we shouldn't be generous to our friends and our coworkers and our family and our siblings and things like that. We also need to be generous and loving and kind to them. But if that's exclusively what our generosity list is, we've got a problem. We need to be generous to people that can't pay us back. The type of people that Jesus is calling to be generous for is not just those that are closest to us, but those that won't ever give us anything back. Jesus is saying that we need to be giving and generous to those that cannot and often will not repay us. And it's really striking what he says here. He says over and over, even sinners do that. Even sinners, even wicked people that have no regard for God, give to people who give back to them. Even they lend to people who will give back exactly what they lent to them. Even they love people that love them and are kind to them. So what makes you so special if that's all that your list is? A disciple of Christ, and one of the distinguishing marks of a disciple of Christ, is who they give to. They give to people that can't repay them. And as I was considering this for myself over this past week, I was a little surprised to notice that the number of people that I contribute towards, whether it's financially or relationally or spiritually, that if I'm really honest, the vast majority of those people are people that I also receive something from. Virtually all of them, I think, are people that I receive something from. And usually that's in some kind of like mutual way, a mutual encouragement that I receive from people or different things like that. And that's often how things like that go. But how many people in your list of people and how many people in your life do you contribute towards that you don't get a thank you from and that you probably won't get a thank you from, that you don't get any repayment back, that you don't necessarily feel appreciated for giving to them and sacrificing your time for them? How many of those people are there in your life? Jesus is saying there needs to be those kinds of people in your life. Give to those types of people. And so how much of your money is going towards people that can't and maybe won't pay you back? Or how much of your conversations are spent with people that can't pay you back? Or how much of your leisure time is spent with people that can't pay you back? It's okay to receive mutual edification and encouragement and things like that. And the Bible talks a lot about that encouragement and building each other up and receiving from one another. But it's also needed to give to people that aren't able to give back. That's the one of the things that Christians have to do. And again, that's hard. That's a hard area of life to change. And again, you ask the question, what could motivate someone to do that? What could motivate a disciple of Christ to be the kind of person that gives to those that won't repay them? And again, I think the answer is in verse 35. Love your enemies, do good and lend, expecting nothing in return, and your reward will be great, and you will be sons of the Most High, for he is kind to ungrateful, the ungrateful, and the evil. If we live our life, and the only way that we're going to be able to follow through on this is becoming the kind of disciple that Jesus is teaching about here that is focused so much more on the future reality than the present reality, because then we'll be willing to sacrifice being repaid and getting something back for other people because we know that a reward is coming for us, and also because we want to be like God. And God does that exact same thing. I like the last phrase in verse 35. God is kind and to the ungrateful and to the evil. I want to be like God, and we're supposed to be being transformed into the image of God and in the image of Christ, and that's the image, giving to those that can't pay them back and probably won't. But God does that day after day after day after day, and Christians and disciples need to do that as well. So that's area number two. The final area, I think, starts in verse 36. And so that third area of influence that will change for us if we're future-focused and not present-focused is that we will forgive those who wrong us. So verse 36 says, "Be merciful even as your Father is merciful. Judge not and you will not be judged. Condemn not and you will not be condemned. Forgive and you will be forgiven. Give and it will be given to you. Good measure, pressed down, shaken together, running over, will be put into your lap. For with the measure that you use, it will be measured back to you." We see this idea in verse 36 where God says, "Be merciful as your Father is merciful." We also see it in verse 38, this idea of forgive and you will be forgiven of what's going on here. And I think this is appropriate coming off of the heels of being giving, because perhaps one of the hardest things to give to people is forgiveness sometimes. And the Bible talks a lot about the need for forgiveness and why we need to forgive and what that actually looks like in various different ways. But forgiveness is needed, and we've talked about this before, whenever there's this wrong that's been suffered. And we mentioned this a few months back in some of my lessons, that really what happens whenever you wrong someone is a debt starts to be incurred. And the Bible kind of talks about this in different areas. Jesus will mention this in one of his prayers in Luke chapter 11, that he prays for the Father to forgive us our debts as we also forgive our debtors. And when you compare that, he's talking about people that sin against you. And so when you sin against someone, do someone wrong, you owe them now. And that's, we reflect that in our language, that you owe them an apology and those types of things. And so there's this debt that needs to be reconciled when something wrong happens to someone else. And at that point, when that debt is incurred, there are really two different options that you can choose. Either you can go to the person that wronged you and demand that the debt be paid, and say, "You owe me right now. You need to right this wrong right now." Or you can cancel the debt through grace and move on. And that's what forgiveness is. Forgiveness is choosing to cancel the debt that's incurred through grace. And I think our constant interactions with people will provide us an abundant amount of opportunities to be wronged. And it could perhaps be that some of us, if we're realistic, it'll be easy for us to carry maybe even dozens of debts that people owe us, waiting for them to pay us back. And, you know, maybe they don't even know that they have those debts or those wrongs against us and that we're waiting for them to pay us back, but we know. And so whenever we see them or we think of them or whatever else, we're just constantly thinking that they did that thing, or maybe they didn't do that thing and they have to right that wrong. But instead, we need to make the choice to just let go of that and just cancel that. Forgiveness is one of those things that I think is maybe one of the most daunting tasks that Christians have to do in their life. It's one of the hardest things to do, and to do completely, and to be like God. And so how can we do that? What's our motivation to be able to forgive, like what Jesus is saying here? I think in the text in Luke 6, he offers two different motivations. One of them is in verse 36. In verse 36, it says, "Be merciful, even as your Father is merciful." Just as your Father is merciful. Nearly every time that Jesus calls his disciples to be forgiving, he reminds us of our own need for forgiveness and what God did for us to forgive us. And that's really kind of step one. Christians are the most forgiven people in all of the world. We've been forgiven the most. And so therefore, we must be and should be the most forgiving people in all of the world. That's really the story of Matthew 18 and the unforgiving servant. If you've been given a lot of forgiveness, a lot of forgiving is expected of you. And so whenever we get into a situation where we feel like maybe my forgiveness tank is running a little empty, and I don't really have as much kind of mojo to forgive that person, go to the cross. Remember how God forgave you. Remember what Christ suffered for you. Think about what Christ did to forgive you your debt. And after thinking about that for maybe 10 seconds, it'll hopefully be a whole lot easier to forgive that person that you're holding a grudge against. The second motivation that Jesus gives, I think, is in verse 38. At the end of verse 38, he says, "With the measure that you use, it will be measured back to you." Sometimes we can maybe want to use different measures of forgiveness for different people in different situations. And I think what Jesus is reminding us here is how we treat others is how we're going to be treated. And that's really kind of calls back to one of the basic principles in verse 31, that as you wish others would do to you, so do also to them. But that also extends to how you treat others is how God will treat you. And that's a really eye-opening kind of reality to start thinking about and contemplating in your life, that, you know, maybe start thinking more seriously about how I treat all of the people in my life, because it's really going to come back around and God is going to remember how I've treated those people. There's this idea where Jesus is calling back to this distinguishing factor that we need to make sure that we are looking to the future and not to the present. Because it can be really uncomfortable sometimes to offer forgiveness, but it can be a whole lot more motivating to offer forgiveness when we realize that forgiveness is needed for me to be forgiven. That I have to forgive for me to be forgiven, and that's the future that I want. I don't want a future where God will not forgive me because I refuse to forgive someone in my life. And so if you're having a hard time forgiving other people, remember what that will mean for your future. Remember that because you're having a hard time forgiving, your future is not bright. And so find the motivation to forgive people. Consider the coming of Jesus. Consider the judgment day. But we all believe in that. We all know that that day is coming. And that's a day when Jesus will come back and evaluate us and examine us and test us for the things that we've done. And on that test, there are going to be things like if we followed his teaching and we kept his commandments and if we were baptized into his death and all of those sorts of things. But also what will be on that test is if we were forgiving to people and how many people that we've forgiven. And if we're still holding on to some of those debts that we've been holding on to for so long. And so if I want to be welcomed by Jesus, then I need to have canceled the debts that are in my life and forgive those people that have wronged me. And thinking about this measuring business that Jesus is talking about here of using these different measures and the measure that you use will be measured back to you. I think that the Bible really teaches that there's only one acceptable measure of forgiveness. And that's the measure of forgiveness that God has given us and he's the pattern to follow. But we can often try to shortchange that and use our own different kinds of measures of forgiveness. And so I want to just think about those measures of forgiveness that we can sometimes use. And maybe we say these outright, or maybe these are just kind of attitudes that we have, but I think maybe some of us can relate to some of these. One measure of forgiveness that we can use is saying, I forgive you, but I just can't be close to you again. That can be a measure of forgiveness or type of forgiveness that we want to offer. Or maybe also, I forgive you, but I refuse to restrain myself in bringing up this wrong in the future. Maybe we wouldn't actually say that to someone when we forgive them, but the next time that there's a problem or a conflict, we're really quick to remind them of the wrong that we suffered from them back in the past. Or maybe another measure of forgiveness we could use is, I forgive you, but you can bet that I'm going to tell my friends and my family about this. People are going to know how you wronged me, and I'm going to share that with everyone. Or maybe, I forgive you if you never wrong me in a similar way again. Maybe some of those are familiar and ways that you've felt in your life in forgiving people. Remember what Jesus says in Luke 6:38. With the measure that you use, it will be measured back to you. I don't know about you guys, but let me ask you this question. When Christ comes back, how many of us would be comfortable with Christ using any of these measures of forgiveness towards us? I forgive you, but I just can't be close to you anymore. I forgive you, but I'm going to keep bringing it up for the rest of eternity, making you feel terrible. I forgive you, but I want to make sure everyone knows how you messed up and how terrible that you used to be. Or I'll only forgive you if you make sure that you're perfect for the rest of our relationship. I don't want to be measured in that way by Christ. And I don't think anyone wants to be measured in that way by Christ. And so we cannot measure other people in that way. Because with the measure that you used, it will be measured back to you. And so that really changes, personally, how I feel about these forgiveness measures. And you could probably come up with some other short changes to true forgiveness. Just remember, how you choose to forgive people is how you will be forgiven. The Bible clearly teaches that over and over and over again. And so when we think about all of these things and all these different areas, and again, like I said, maybe you could categorize these different things in other ways, but this is what Jesus says will change when you become a disciple of his. This is what the character of a disciple looks like. It's someone that is constantly looking to the future above the present and loving those who mistreat them, giving back to those that are giving to those that can't give back, and forgiving those who wrong you. And so let's find the strength to look to the future and the promises that God has given us and help one another to do that and be able to forego our current plans or our current desires and to achieve God's will in these different ways. Because this is hard. This is hard stuff that Jesus is saying, but this is what it means to be a disciple. This is who a disciple is. And if we're not there yet, we better start getting there and really start training ourselves in these ways that Jesus wants us to train ourselves in. So I hope that's helpful for us to think about tonight. We'll continue in chapter 7, and I think next week notice a good example of a disciple in one of these areas anyway, and so we'll start that next week. But if this evening, maybe you realize that you're falling short in some discipleship areas, and you really need the help and the prayers of the church here to mature and grow more in these areas, and again, have prayers for you and encouragement to do those things, that's why we gather together. That's why we're a part of the same body together, to help one another and encourage one another to grow and be more like the people Christ wants us to be. And so if you need the help of the church here tonight, you can come forward and talk to me about that while we stand and sing this hymn.